Tom Hall. Welcome to the Midday News Wrap. Terrorists strike the London subway again. Despite increased sanctions, North Korea fires another missile. The Department of Justice decides not to pursue civil rights charges against the officers who arrested Freddie Gray. Hillary Clinton tries to explain what happened. Bernie Sanders proposes Medicare for all. Democrats say there's a DACA deal. The president said they're working on it and that the wall will come later. Michael Fletcher is a senior writer for ESPN's The Undefeated. Andrew Revkin of ProPublica was a longtime environmental reporter for The New York Times. They join me to look behind the headlines. Plus, David Hildebrand and Elizabeth Schaff on their new book, Musical Maryland. The Midday News Wrap is coming right up after these headlines. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us for Midday. Today, it's the Midday News Wrap. Lots to discuss this week. A bomb exploded in southwest London in a subway station during rush hour this morning. At least 22 people have been hospitalized, none with life-threatening injuries. It is the fifth act of terrorism in Britain this year. The death toll from Hurricane Irma continues to rise as cleanup continues. At least 39 people on the U.S. mainland and at least 43 people in the Caribbean have died as a result of Irma. 15 million people are still without power. FEMA and the Trump administration get generally high marks for their response so far. This morning, North Korea fired a missile over Japan just days after the U.N. strengthened sanctions. Equifax faces lawsuits and blistering criticism over its handling of a massive data breach. On Wednesday night, Democratic leaders Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer dined on Chinese food with President Trump at the White House, and then they issued a statement saying that they had reached an agreement about DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. Yesterday morning, the president tweeted that there was no deal, and then he said they were working on a plan. Breitbart News called it a full-fledged cave. In the latest round of congressional health care wrangling, independent Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders has unveiled a Medicare for All bill. In her new book, Hillary Clinton calls her decision about emails a dumb mistake and an even dumber scandal as she tries to tell the world what happened. The Department of Justice said this week that none of the Baltimore police officers who were charged in the 2015 death of Freddie Gray will face federal civil rights charges in his death. I'm joined today here in Studio A by Michael Fletcher of ESPN's The Undefeated, where he is a senior writer. Good to see you, Mike.
Good to be back, Tom.
And joining us from the studios of NPR in New York is Andrew Revkin. He's the senior reporter for climate and related issues at ProPublica, which he joined late last year after 21 years with The New York Times. Andrew, welcome to the show. Thanks for your time.
Glad to be here.
If you'd like to join our conversation here at Midday, 410-662-8780 is our phone number, our email midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. So, Andrew, let's talk about Hurricane Irma. You've covered this. What are the latest damage estimates? Where do things stand this afternoon in terms of Florida's efforts to rebuild?
Well, some of the critical things are getting the power back on, and they've actually been going pretty quickly in most big chunks of the state. But parts of the state could see weeks go by before power is back. The deaths in a nursing home that were reported a couple of days ago show you the, you think of electricity mostly as kind of an indulgence, keeps the refrigerator, keeps your air conditioning going. But in that case, air conditioning was a life and death thing, and not to mention the other failures there. So power matters hugely. Structural losses are going to take time. They haven't even fully tallied in billions the cost yet from the Houston, Harvey in Houston. These things piled up pretty quickly, and it'll be tens of billions, if not. Well, there's one estimate in the last 24 hours that the two together could end up with a couple $100 billion price tag. What that means locally, historically, it's kind of weird, but when you think about it, it's not so weird. In the long haul, it stimulates the economy, which is strange, but it does. More federal money comes into a state, and states that are more vulnerable get more money than states that aren't. So there are debates about how that plays out going forward. But, you know, these economies are going to take time to come back. Houston's is seen as more resilient just because it's a powerhouse kind of economy already. So, we'll see, but it takes time to get the full tally.
You've written the last couple of days about this notion of resilient infrastructure. And the new thinking surrounding that, given these two, you know, as you say, back-to-back very significant disasters. What do people mean by the term resilient infrastructure, and where do you think that conversation is headed?
Well, it's got two it has sort of the old-style definition, which is the ability to bounce back. But what scientists and engineers and sort of risk manager wonks have been telling me, you know, I live in wonk world. I am a wonk. I have to admit it. I think they say in a world with a changing climate, and not to mention fast forward socioeconomic change, the idea of bouncing back to where you were has no real salience anymore. So how do you define for a state like Florida or state or region like around Houston, where, you know, these are two of the fastest growing places in the country? Sea level rise and heavier downpours mean that you can't rely on past projections for making your flood standards for your sewers or whatever. So how do you bounce forward, or how do you kind of create a new way to plan your infrastructure, to plan investments, to structure insurance that guarantees you're not just building back more vulnerability? So that's the key part.
The National Flood Insurance Program, you wrote about this as well, and the fact that so many people from all sides of the aisle and from the technical side, the legislative side, have criticized it. You say that it often works to simply subsidize instead of mitigate against vulnerability. Do you think that this is going to be a thing that the fact that Harvey and Irma have happened will occasion a closer look at that particular program?
Well, yeah, it will. But we've kind of been through this cycle before. After Sandy, Congress finally got serious about a number of years ago, and actually several times, Congress has kind of said we need to redo this. So there isn't what they call repetitive loss. There's this, if you Google online for repetitive loss in FEMA, and there are some places in America that have been reimbursed for a house that's gotten destroyed 40 times in flooding, and we write a check. And so taxpayers are doing something that, you know, a libertarian or a liberal who's concerned about climate, or libertarian is just concerned about subsidies of bad behavior, you know, they all agree. But what happened was the last exercise after Sandy, they passed a bill, Biggert Waters bill, that did start to rationalize flood insurance costs. You know, it's basically subsidized. And then there was kind of a backlash, and it was a bipartisan backlash. Republicans and Democrats, who homeowners, said, "Well, my gosh, my rates are going up. I can't live here anymore." And they rolled back the bill. So, and I imagine, you know, so that's the question: can there be some true structural change now? You know, there'll be debate. They just booted it. It was supposed to be the bill, the reauthorization of the program, was supposed to happen this month, but they've booted it to later in the year, toward the end of the year, to see what happens.
Yeah.
My guess is it'll be kind of like Groundhog Day.
Yeah. And Mike Fletcher, I mean, you know, rebuilding the same house 40 times. I mean, you got to think, what does a taxpayer in Nebraska or Wyoming or Maryland, for that matter,
Baltimore.
Yeah, Baltimore, think about that.
Yeah, I know.
You know, I mean, there's other pressing needs as well besides rebuilding somebody's beach house. Generally speaking, FEMA, I think, has gotten decent grades for their response to this. Brock Long, a relatively new administrator, he didn't start that gig until June of this year. What's people's reaction been so far? Because we hear so much about the disorganization and the chaotic nature of the Trump administration. Was that at all in evidence during their response?
Well, no. I think, like you, everything I've read and seen seems to sort of give high marks to FEMA and the response from even President Trump. And President Trump, one thing he can do, one thing he understands, is this idea of marketing and showmanship, if you will. So he was out there in Houston, sort of showing his face at the relief efforts. He's done the same in Florida. He's tweeted about this. He's been visible on this. All very different from the response, the initial response, at least from President Bush when you had Katrina.
And it seems like he's gotten over the initial bump, because the first trip he made to Texas, he talked about the crowd size. He did not meet with anybody who had been affected by the storm. And then he, you know, went back to
Washington.
But he
kind of kept at it, right.
And then when he came back, he had sort of learned.
Yeah, the first thing we know was his wife's shoes and all of that sort of thing. But he sort of stayed more, you know, as focused as this president stays, and sort of, you know, kept, you know, tried to sort of show some empathy. And people, I think, have applauded him for that. I mean, you have to be fair there. I think people say he's done a good job when it comes to this, and the federal government response has been good. But at the same time, you know, we're also lucky, right? I mean, as bad as particularly Irma was, it wasn't as bad as it's feared, right? If that hurricane had tracked a little further east and hit, say, Miami the way they had predicted, we would have had a whole different scale of catastrophe. And, you know, in many ways, Katrina was a worst-case scenario because, you know, at one point, you know, everyone thought, you know, New Orleans had dodged a bullet, right, because the storm kind of hit, I think, a little bit east of New Orleans.
Then the levees broke.
Then the levees broke, and it changed the whole scale and nature of that of that disaster.
And Andrew Revkin, over in at FEMA, I mean, Brock Long seems to get pretty high marks. On the other hand, the president's nominee for the number two person, a guy named Daniel Craig, who worked at FEMA during the Bush administration, during Katrina, has withdrawn his nomination because there's questions about some ethical violations that he committed while he was in the current or the previous administration. Is FEMA equipped in the long term, you know, in terms of their staffing and in terms of the funding, because the Trump administration, at least in one blueprint for their budget, had proposed cutting FEMA funding pretty significantly.
Well, it's not just a question of the leadership positions like that. The Trump budget has had proposals to cut programs that map flood mitigation, hazard zones, you know, that kind of thing. So your capacity to do the grunt work before a storm, to know where to position your responses or where you want to discourage development, that if that capacity goes away, it doesn't really matter who's in the leadership roles. And one thing to note is that this pattern of sort of, in this case, a withdrawn nominee, or if you look across the landscape of the agencies that deal with weather, climate, disaster resilience, they're still mostly unnominated positions. NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, you know, they've all done really amazing work these last few weeks through this stretch of storms. But the capacity to make decisions, capacity to sustain the systems that do the monitoring, that do the analysis, if those get weakened, then that could lead to a lot of problems, according to many people I talk to.
Before we take a break, Andrew, of course, the Caribbean was also devastated by this. You got countries like Barbuda, which are just completely sacked. I mean, it's just a horrible thing. And actually, more deaths occurred in the Caribbean than occurred here in the U.S. mainland. Is there an inclination, a propensity to help non-American countries rebuild themselves? I mean, obviously, the U.S. Virgin Islands were part of the territories hit. But what's the Trump administration posture going to be towards helping out our neighbors to the south?
The issues for several of those islands are more for the French and the Dutch. And, you know, these are not like poor developing countries for the most part, the ones that got hurt. They're parts of
St. Martin.
They're sort of within the sphere of countries that are, you know, already also prosperous and able to respond. Generally, what I've been reporting on other fronts is that the programs like U.S. Agency for International Development, the U.S. contribution to climate programs internationally are, if not already cut, they're poised to be cut. And that weakens, and this, by the way, transcends climate change, whatever Trump thinks about global warming. We live on a planet where there's fast rising populations in poor countries and vulnerable places. And here we have fast rising development in poor and vulnerable places. So if you have policies or if you lack the capacity to, in this case that you're talking about, if you lack the capacity to help bolster resilience in trouble zones, then that's going to create troubles that will ripple far beyond the location. Just right now in the Middle East, Yemen, there's a looming famine that's been underway, largely unnoticed. These dry zones in sub-Saharan Africa that I've written about before, the vulnerability there is not a climate change issue. It's a climate vulnerability issue. It's an area with drought baked into its climate system already. And, you know, population heading toward doubling in the next 30 years, that's if we don't have the capacity as the United States to somewhat focus on issues like that or in hurricane zones, then we're creating a more turbulent world.
We'll have more of the Midday News Wrap with Andrew Revkin, the senior reporter for climate and related issues at ProPublica, and Michael Fletcher, a senior writer at ESPN's The Undefeated, when we come back after a quick break. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. To join us on Twitter, you can find us @MiddayTomHall. Stick around. Back. It's the Midday News Wrap. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up a little later, a conversation with Elizabeth Schaff and David Hildebrand about their new book, which traces the history of music in Maryland from colonial times through the 20th century. And by the way, coming up Monday here on Midday, Len Lazarick, the editor and publisher of MarylandReporter.com. He's going to be here to talk about his new memoir about Columbia, Maryland, which turns 50 this year. And Amy Davis, who's a terrific photographer for the Baltimore Sun, will tell us about her stunning new book of photographs called Flickering Treasures, Rediscovering Baltimore's Forgotten Movie Houses. If you've just joined us today, it's the Midday News Wrap. Michael Fletcher is here in Studio A. He's a senior writer at The Undefeated. That's ESPN's online platform that explores the intersection of race, culture, and sports. He was for many years a reporter for The Washington Post, where he covered the national economic scene. He covered the Obama administration, the Bush White House, and many other subjects. He also wrote a terrific book about Clarence Thomas. Andrew Revkin is on the line with us from NPR in New York. He's the senior reporter for climate and related issues at ProPublica. He was for 21 years a reporter at the New York Times, where he wrote the popular Dot Earth blog. You can join our conversation here on the News Wrap, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. So Mike Fletcher, FEMA funding, staffing, all sort of interconnected to conversations about the debt ceiling, conversations about the budget. It appears that the Democrats had two sort of big wins in the last week or so. First, they got a 3-month deal to extend the debt ceiling, and then they appear to have at least inched the president considerably closer to a deal on DACA. Let's talk about the debt ceiling. First of all, Republicans wanted an 18-month deal because it would take them through the 2018 election. Do you buy the narrative that the Democrats picked up all sorts of leverage, given the fact that the a debt ceiling vote's going to have to happen on the 8th of December?
You know, I'm not sure that I do. I mean, I guess it's all relative here, right? The idea of them working with Trump is startling, right, in many ways, given where we've been, right, and where we've been, the relationships between the White House and Congress. So the leverage really depends on Donald Trump himself, right, and how, you know, how good is his commitment to this, to these deals. And I think that remains to be seen. But, I mean, in the short term, I mean, it's the best Democrats could do.
Yeah. Andrew Revkin, folks have said that the president has actually given Congress, Mr. Ryan and Mr. McConnell in particular, a break by owning DACA. He has taken DACA on himself. Of course, he is the person that announced he was going to end the program, which forces Congress's hand to have a vote on a bill that would enshrine in statute what President Obama did by executive order. Do you think he has, in fact, taken the pressure off Congress here? I mean, there's an awful lot of people upset with him for apparently, you know, rescinding an oft-repeated claim he made during the campaign. But where do you think what's your crystal ball tell you about where the DACA conversation is going to head?
Well, there's a broader pattern. You know, I'm not one of the reporters dug in on that issue, but I do see a pattern here where if you look back at things that Trump pledged to do during the campaign or that become sort of poster issues for him, you know, simple ones. If he has to find a way to cross that off, you know, in a very sort of dramatic thespian way. And then what happens is you see behind the scenes the same pattern with DACA is unfolding right now with flood insurance. Just to give you, I'll give you two quick examples that are the same pattern, then people can judge whether there's a common element. Flood insurance, remember he, August 15th, big announcement, cutting Obama's program that would have required flood standards for stuff that gets federal money that's being built in a danger zone. And now his Tom Bossert at FEMA just 2 days ago in Florida, I mean, looking at Florida, was saying, oh, no, no, they're coming up with their own flood standard. You know, it, and then on Paris, the Paris Climate Treaty, big announcement, boom, it's done. But it takes 4 years to actually have that play out. And already there are signals from the Trump administration behind the scenes that, you know, some more serious approach to it's underway and on and on. There's other examples in other arenas. So that's, I think that's this pattern, whether it was conscious or just sort of a practical, you know, thing where he gets out ahead of his own policy people. Yeah, I don't know how many people know the answer to that question.
Mike Fletcher, moving on to the Department of Justice, they have decided not to pursue federal civil rights charges against any of the six officers that the local state's attorney general, Marilyn Mosby, charged in the death that occurred during the arrest and detention of Freddie Gray back in 2015. Just today, an officer in St. Louis, Jason Stockley, was acquitted of the shooting death of a young African-American man, Anthony Lamar Smith, in St. Louis. We have this meeting with Congressman Tim Scott, the only African-American Republican congressman with the president, who, Mr. Scott, very disconcerted, as were millions of other people, about the president's comments following the violence in Charlottesville. How does this all add up? Where do you think this puts us?
I think we almost have to take them separately, right? You start with the last one you raised. You talk about people being disconcerted about President Trump's comments following Charlottesville, and the sort of his shocking kind of equivalency, you know, between the fascists and, you know, anti-Semitic protesters and the counter-protesters. You know, so the president meets with Senator Scott, who was upset, like many people, as you point out. And then a day after the meeting, he basically says, well, you know, I stand by my original comments. There were bad actors on both sides of the divide here. And that's what I've been trying to get across. It's sort of interesting. It's sort of just eyebrow raising at this point. It used to be more shocking, I guess, but we're getting kind of used to, you know, President Trump talk about patterns, like his pattern to double down is... You know, yeah. It's almost unbroken.
It's well trodden.
Yeah, exactly.
Path.
I know when it comes to these police cases, it's hardly shocking to me that the officers in the Freddie Gray case, you know, that federal prosecutors didn't bring civil rights charges, because they almost never do, because they're very difficult to bring, and they're very, you know, if you couldn't prove a criminal case that was vigorously tried in Baltimore, you said, you know, Marilyn Mosby basically became a national figure by deciding to charge the officers, and those cases really went, you know, nowhere. If you listen to what that judge talked about, a judge who, you know, I've pointed this out before, this is, you know, people say judge, but this is a judge who used to prosecute, you know, bad cops and, you know, sort of had, you know, sort of like, if you're someone looking for justice here, kind of the perfect track record to kind of adjudicate this. So there was not a case, I mean, not to say we know what happened with Freddie Gray, but the evidence wasn't there to convict, it looked like. And so I think the Justice Department's action is almost, it's expected by me at least. And it's, you know, I don't know what to make of it other than to say, well, they didn't have the evidence there. And I'm not so sure that, you know, it's outrageous, right? I don't know what happened in St. Louis, but these cases, people tend to, you know, pull all these cases together, but some are, I think, more outrageous than others. And some maybe aren't outrageous at all when you get to the bottom line of what actually happened. So I think we have to be careful to sort of take them kind of one by one, but people lump them together. And understandably so, because you've had this narrative in, you know, sort of American life for the last, for the last couple of generations of police brutality and all of that. But you still actually have to look case by case, and particularly when you're talking about, you know, someone's freedom and justice and things like that.
And Andrew Revkin, do you sense, and I'll confess that I do, just over the last couple of weeks, beginning with the conversation about the debt ceiling and then continuing with the conversation that the president had with Mr. Schumer and Ms. Pelosi about DACA, that the media narrative about Donald Trump is beginning to change. I mean, we had tweets this morning where he's, you know, back to his old rhetorical style, talking about the loser terrorists in London, which, you know, still gives people quite a bit of pause. He says that the travel ban into the U.S. should be far larger and tougher. He's, you know, doubling down there. He bragged about the progress being made against ISIS. But then he was also tweeting about chain migration and DACA, and he even threw in a jab at Mike's colleagues at ESPN. That all happened before 9 o'clock this morning. But, you know, you wrote, Andrew, about the media coverage concerning the hurricane. You know, people talking about a Category 6 hurricane and stuff, which is unfortunately a category that doesn't exist. And some other things, you know, there is fake news even surrounding the coverage of the hurricane. Do you think that there's a new attitude about Mr. Trump, given what he's accomplished in the last couple of weeks?
Oh, gosh. This is an arena where prediction is a dangerous practice or even characterization. I still, in looking at things like evolving climate policy or basically on any of these issues, there's still open debates, as far as I can tell, about how much of what's unfolded is purposeful or the result of a lack of purpose. And you know, you can make up your own narrative to suit any one of the several kinds of positions there. I think it's still the best way to look at this is it's kind of the political equivalent of an asteroid strike or something. You know, it's something that completely anomalous. He defied so many norms in getting elected. The system, meaning the system of even the media system and how to react. The advocates on different issues have been sort of deer in the headlights for a while. And there was this urgent early, expression among many people, you know, who see this as dangerously disruptive, that there'll be some quick route where he'll be out of office. And now it's sort of slowly emerging that this is whatever you wish for, this is going to take time to play out. And so this is all an area where I think if you have an issue you want to pursue, whether it's a position on DACA or a position on climate, get dug in, find your place, and see where real-world possibilities have meaning. And I do think one thing I've seen, a lot of people have started to realize that a broader dialogue outside of their bubbles is essential. If we all stay in sort of tweet mode and distilling everything in 140 characters and still thinking that some less educated person in a Rust Belt town is your enemy without actually, you know, finding a way to engage with people like that, if that stuff is not happening, or if this wasn't a signal that more of that should happen, then there'll be more trouble going forward.
I just have to second that. But unfortunately, it feels like we're not moving in that direction. It's almost like we're sort of burying ourselves deeper in our own silos, it feels like to me. I mean, you talk about, you know, you used the term fake news, Tom. You know, it's almost like people don't care. I would call it an inaccuracy to say, you know, someone says it's a Category 6 hurricane. You know, we don't blink anymore. Like, people say all kinds of stuff now. And it's, I think, a confluence of the way the media landscape.
Including the president.
Yeah, well,
who,
yeah,
of course, has a great proclivity for just making stuff up.
And I think that is a confluence between his influence, which I think is changing. It's kind of ruffled everyone. We don't even know how to respond to that. How do you deal? Do we become more civil? But that feels like that's not talking loud enough. Do you yell back? I think the media is in a position almost like a lot of his political opponents were. You know, they didn't know whether do I act more presidential? Do you do the Marco Rubio and try to get down into the gutter and fight? But you don't win that fight because he's good at that fight. You know, so I think we've kind of seen these strands kind of come together in a way that we're going to have to work out over time. And whether we ever go back to an old normal, I don't know. Maybe we don't.
Yeah. 410-662-8780. That's our number here at Midday. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. I'm here in Studio A with Mike Fletcher from ESPN's The Undefeated, and joining us from NPR in New York, Andrew Revkin, who's the senior reporter for climate and related issues at ProPublica. Let's go to the phones. Clarence in New Freedom, Pennsylvania. Welcome to Midday.
Good. How's everybody doing, Tom?
Doing great today. Running scared, but straight ahead.
What we have to do is there's a lot of issues that aren't coming through because Donald Trump tweets and people forget. Authorization was sent to Congress for war. We bombed Syria without an authorization. We're living off an authorization from 2001. With the photo op for Tim Scott yesterday, day before yesterday, he had a photo op with an African-American senator who's the only African-American Republican. They mislabeled his name. Donald Trump stuck with his same ideas about what went on in Virginia. The public needs to understand that this man, and see, you all can't say it, but as a citizen, I can say it. He'll lie at the crack of dawn. And our country is being taken down a route that's not really, really good. I have friends that live in Botswana, South Africa. They want to know how come this man was elected. He respects no one. The media made him. It's going to take the media to bring him down. So,
Clarence, I appreciate the call. We take your point. Speaking of the media, the president, Mike Fletcher, had some things to say about a colleague of yours over at ESPN, Jemele Hill. She was tweeting when you talk about getting down and yelling louder. I mean, she tweeted with, of all people, Kid Rock, the musician, and his, you know, political ambitions notwithstanding. Kid Rock invited somewhat famously to the White House with Sarah Palin, et cetera. This tweet that Jemele Hill sent out about the president being a white supremacist made it to the White House briefing room because there is Sarah Huckabee Sanders responding to it. And ESPN, your boss, your employer, responded to it, evidently trying to at least give her a few days off the air until things blew over.
Yeah, and she ended up, you know, not getting those days off. But it puts ESPN in a tough position. That's something, you know, since I joined this company, you realize that it's not – I've worked in the past strictly for media companies, you know, journalistic outfits.
And the Baltimore Sun, the Washington
Baltimore Sun and Washington Post, exactly. You realize that E and ESPN is for entertainment. So I think ESPN worries a lot about kind of polarizing their audience, right? You know, and particularly when you're talking about something like sports, a place where as fractured as our society has become, that's one place where people come together. So they worry about, you know, us expressing kind of ad hominem political views. Like the Undefeated is in a kind of a different lane, but they don't want us just like, you know, name calling, right? But that's where Donald Trump has scrambled the deck. I mean, because he does it all the time. He's done it. And he's called people racist. He's done that. And so Jemele gets into this back and forth with somebody online and says what she said about Donald Trump. Then the press secretary is asked about it at the briefing. Then it becomes kind of a national, international story. Then the president tweets about it some more. And then, you know, and they point to what they call a double standard. You know, Kurt Schilling was let go from ESPN for expressing, you know, a number, you know, even though he was warned a number of times, but he continuously expressed kind of right-wing views and ended up being let go from the company. So, you know, it put ESPN kind of in a bad position, I feel like.
Well, of course, as you say, I mean, the president really does have the upper hand. I mean, here he is tweeting the other day that ESPN tried to take Jemele Hill off the air after White House condemnation. And, you know, people are dumping ESPN. They're playing a really big price for its politics and bad programming. They're dumping it in record numbers.
I know.
You know, that's
it, it
not
kind of creates,
true.
It creates this opening for him to sort of like, you know, kind of create his own narrative, if you will. Yeah. And he can also sort of act like the aggrieved party when he, you know, if you go through his Twitter history, you know, we don't have to, you know, go through it, but, you know, it's, I mean, he's the godfather of this stuff.
Yeah. He knows how to do it. Andrew Refkin, again, I know you're not covering politics, you're covering climate change and the environment and such things, but what's your reaction to Hillary Clinton's, fairly quick return to the scene? It's not that long after the election. It's less than a year. She's now written a book that she somewhat boldly entitles What Happened. So she's going to explain to us what happened in November of last year. Is that good news for the Democrats that she's back and she's, explicating her interpretation of the events? Or do you think politically that's something that doesn't help the Democrats moving forward?
Oh, boy. Well, I guess I'd have to say many Democrats would see that as worrisome. But it's part of the Democratic process. When I say that, I mean the process within the Democratic Party seems to be implicitly fractious. Obviously, the Republican Party is going through this now on its own terms. Until they come up with some viable candidates, you know, who are not too old or not too this or not too that, then she has every right, certainly, to you know, elbow her way back in if she wants to do that. It's not clear yet what her aspiration is, but I think it's just the way.
Although she has said she's through with politics, that elective office is not an option for her.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah,
all right. Well, I believe that someday
when we see it. Yeah,
right.
Mike Fletcher, before we take off here, Equifax, this enormous breach of security, the kind of security that everybody is so fearful. I mean, this is different than Target or Home Depot, you know, giving up a little credit card information. This is names, social security numbers.
License numbers.
Yeah, so, you know, date of birth, you know, legal name. So it most likely affects you, Andrew, me, and everybody listening to this program.
Right. And, you know, and the worst part about it all, you know, none of us had a say in this. It's not like, you know, like Target, you know, we signed up for a Target credit card. Equifax got our information without us, you know, giving it to them, right?
Mm-hmm. You know, so. Richard Cordray, who's the current director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the kind of agency that's charged with making sure this kind of stuff doesn't happen. It's likely he will run for governor of Ohio and leave mm-hmm. that agency. The Trump administration has spoken ill of that agency. Is this another instance where the Trump administration is going to have to confront the fact that there needs to perhaps be some sort of government watchdog entity keeping an eye on these for-profit companies like Equifax?
One would think, you know, but we just talked about the world we live in and the media environment we live in and the kind of the level of information that we exchange as a society. You know, these 140 characters, the fake Facebook posts, this, that, and the other. I don't know that people get more than a level or two deep, and this might be two or three levels deep. You would think, you would hope that this would sort of fan some kind of or spark some kind of sense that yes, we really do need real consumer watchdogs, but I'm not sure that people connect it like that. I hope they do, but I worry that they don't.
All right, well, we have done our best to connect a few of the dots in the news this week. Mike Fletcher, it's always good to see you. I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
And Andrew Revkin joining us this afternoon from New York. I appreciate your reporting and your time with us this afternoon. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
Andrew Revkin is the senior reporter for climate and related issues at ProPublica. He's a former longtime reporter for the New York Times. He's written books on global warming, the changing Arctic, and the assault on the Amazon rainforest, among others. Michael Fletcher is a senior writer at The Undefeated. That's ESPN's online platform that explores the intersection of race, culture, and sports. He was for many years a reporter for The Washington Post and The Baltimore Sun, and he's the co-author of a great biography of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, the rich history of music in Maryland. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.